Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. It was the biggest funeral Chicago had seen since Lincoln's. On May 26, 1889, 4,000 mourners proceeded down Michigan Avenue, followed by a crowd 40,000 strong, in a howl of protest at what commentators called one of the ghastliest and most curious crimes in civilized history. The dead man, Dr. P.H. Cronin, was a respected Irish physician, but his brutal murder uncovered a web of intrigue, secrecy, and corruption that stretched across the United States and far beyond. Blood Runs Green tells the story of Cronin's murder from the police investigation to the trial. It is a story of hot-headed journalists in pursuit of sensational crimes, of a bungling police force riddled with informers and spies, and of a secret revolutionary society determined to free Ireland from Britain, but succeeding only in tearing itself apart. It is also the story of a booming immigrant population clamoring for power at a time of unprecedented change. From backrooms to courtrooms, historian Gillian O'Brien deftly navigates the complexities of Irish Chicago, bringing to life a rich cast of characters and tracing the spectacular rise and fall of the secret Irish-American society, Clan na Gael. She draws on real-life accounts and sources from the United States, Ireland, and Britain to cast new light on Clan na Gael and reveal how Irish republicanism swept across the United States. Destined to be a true crime classic, Blood Runs Green is an enthralling tale of a murder that captivated the world and reverberated through society long after the coffin closed. The book that we are featuring this evening is Blood Runs Green, with my special guest, journalist, author, and historian, Gillian O'Brien. And Gillian O'Brien is calling from Liverpool, England, today, and using our direct connect with the instructions provided by Blog Talk Radio, and we have a problem connecting. For those unfortunate persons that will listen to this live, which are a handful, we will give Gillian the customary few minutes to try to connect, and I will edit this portion out. I don't always promise to do that, but I will. And if not, I'm sure Gillian is still very interested in being interviewed regarding her book, Blood Runs Green, and there she is right now. Good evening, Gillian O'Brien.
Good evening.
I just did the introduction for your book, Blood Runs Green. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. I know you're calling from your home in Liverpool. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I want to thank you very much. Let's start off with really the necessary background on your book, the history behind the formation of the secret Irish Republican move, and in terms of the societies that were predecessed or were prior to the Clan na Gael. And so tell us about the Fenians and before the Clan na Gael, and tell us about that whole formation of Irish secret societies and the formation of this Clan na Gael. And if I mispronounced that, please correct me.
No, you're quite accurate. Well, the Fenians and Clan na Gael come out of, I suppose, they're post the Irish famine when huge numbers of Irish had emigrated, and many of them to the United States, many of them to Canada. And there was a growing belief that the only way to defeat the British and to regain or gain control of Ireland and establish an Irish Republic was through using force to do so, so that constitutional means wouldn't necessarily work. And so a number of groups were established, and probably the most well-known of those was the Fenian group, which was established in the late 1850s. And that group was a secret society, and it was dedicated to using force to try and establish an Irish Republic. And very often in these Irish secret societies, the very first thing on any agenda is the split. And so there were a lot of divisions within those groups between how they would achieve this freedom and the various strategies that would use and the level of connection they would have with their counterparts in Ireland and in Britain. And so the Fenian movement ultimately had sort of a series of uprisings or attempted uprisings in the late 1860s, particularly in 1867. And there were, again, they weren't as successful as they thought they would be. And out of the sort of disappointment associated with the lack of success, you have a split in the Fenian movement. And out of that, you get the establishment of a group called Clan na Gael, which means the family of the Irish or the family of the Gael. Right. And that's the group that I was particularly interested in when I came to write the book.
Now, let's talk about also the... you talked about the strategy to be able to free Ireland from Britain, and that's what this was about. But this also comes from a tradition of these secret societies in Ireland, like you mentioned the Hibernians and the Freemasons and other fractured societies. So tell us a little bit more about, again, because very important, we talk about spies and how they would try to weed out informers in these organizations, and especially as the Clan na Gael and it progressed further. So tell us about the importance in secret societies and some of the codes that were involved and where it really came from, the traditions.
Well, the tradition really of secret societies, certainly in Irish republicanism, goes back to the end of the 18th century. And at the end of the 18th century, there was a group established called the Society of United Irishmen. And that society was set up really inspired by the French Revolution, and they set themselves up to achieve Irish independence, and they led in 1798 the largest rebellion ever seen on Irish soil. Now, one of the problems with the Society of United Irishmen is that it was a secret society, and it was designed to operate in secret, but one of the issues that they had was that they held many of their meetings would be held in essentially saloons or bars, which isn't ideal for any sort of secret society, because once a lot of alcohol has been taken, very often the secrets mm-hmm. begin to pass around those areas.
Sure.
And so later generations had recognized that there were issues to do with secrecy and the problems with secrecy within these Irish Republican organizations. And so by the time you get to the Fenian movement, they have established quite a developed sort of level of secrecy, and they are inspired by sort of the Freemasons and a number of other organizations. So there are things like secret codes. So if you were to meet a member of Clan na Gael or the Fenians, you would... If you were a member and you wanted to alert another man to another man that was a member, you would run your finger along the inside of your collar from sort of where your ear is down towards your neck. And you would do that twice. And that would indicate to the person you were looking at that you were a member. If they recognized that symbol, they would respond by running the middle finger of their right hand down the side of their face. So then you would recognize each other and be able to converse about sort of secret matters. So they had all sorts of sort of secret signs in that way. They also, in some cases, wrote in invisible ink. And they had a code, the Clonagel had a code that they used, a sort of secret cipher, which they wrote in code. Now, the problem with that was that it was a very easily, it was a very discoverable code. So all they did was they replaced one letter with another. So you would replace the letter I with the letter J. So each letter that came after it in the alphabet would be replaced. So it was extremely easy to decipher. And therefore, any time a letter was intercepted, the British police would easily know what the plans were.
Now, you talk about the Klan was founded in the U.S. in New York, and they call that District A. And in Chicago was a huge Irish presence. And you can tell us about what I'm referring to in terms of the importance of Chicago at that time as a city as well. But it was Chicago was District K, and which also included all of Illinois and Michigan. So tell us a little bit about that before we talk about the importance of fundraising in all of this.
Well, the East Coast of the United States was where a lot of these organizations started, and that isn't really a surprise because a lot of those who became members of these organizations had come from Ireland during the Great Irish Famine of the 1840s and in the years afterwards. And so most of those who arrived would have arrived along the east, the eastern seaboard. So they would have landed into Boston or they would have landed into New York. And they established themselves in those cities. And they then spread through the United States. So most of these organizations began along the eastern seaboard. But as the trains moved towards the west, as new opportunities for growth and for jobs developed, many of the Irish in New York, in Boston, and other places also moved west. And one of the places that they moved to was Chicago. A lot of them moved to part of doing building the big canal network. An awful lot moved because of the stockyards and the employment available in the stockyards. A lot of them moved because of the railways. And so you have a move west, as far west really as San Francisco, where you begin to have a large Irish population. So by the time we get to the 1880s, and particularly in the period after the Great Fire of 1871, when Chicago had to entirely rebuild itself, and it did with great enthusiasm, but it also did with huge manpower, and many Irish came and rebuilt Chicago into something that was sort of bigger and better and grander than it had existed before. And that's really why you get that move from the East Coast to the Midwest, but it's also because the leadership of the Catholic Church, and most of these Irish who were involved were Catholic, the leadership of the Catholic Church in Chicago was more sympathetic towards radical Irish republicanism than it was in other parts of the United States.
Right. Now, you talk about the numerous St. Patrick's Day and other celebrations, holidays that the Irish celebrated, pardon me, and you also talked about fundraising and then the lure of jobs. So for sheer numbers and for the Clonagel, how important were these picnics, fundraisers, and the influence that a lot of these people were interested in jobs and there was promises of jobs with membership?
Yeah, well, that's very true. I mean, I don't know that they ever directly promised jobs, but it was certainly the case that if you were a member and if you knew senior members of Clonagel who tended to be relatively well off, I mean, there was definitely a sort of class structure, so that the leaders of Clonagel and the other organizations were very often, they were journalists or they were lawyers or they had senior positions in the police force. And a lot of the sort of rank and file members would have been laborers or unskilled workers. Now, in Chicago, if you were arriving in Chicago as an unskilled laborer, you certainly needed a job. And you wouldn't have been long in Chicago before somebody would suggest that joining Clonagel was the way forward to getting a job. Now, in terms of raising money, Clonagel and other groups really did raise a lot of money through their picnics, through the St. Patrick's Day parades, and that money, and through membership, you had to pay a sub to become a member, and you would pay a weekly amount as well. And that money was used to pay for their campaigns to achieve Irish freedom. So the attraction really for many people was the job over Irish freedom, and they put that first and foremost, and Irish freedom was very much a secondary affair.
This push for Irish independence really had, and you chronicle it in your book, some major events that really helped ignite the population and rally the population in a certain concerted effort, finally. And including, you talk about T.D. Sullivan's God Save Ireland, which became basically the national anthem for in practicality. And you talk about some of the Fenian prisoners that were given amnesty, and you talked about the Irish Republican Brotherhood and Dvoy Donovan Rosa when he was handcuffed behind his back for 35 days. Tell us about a couple of these events that really helped to shape this movement.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, they required, I suppose, some great big sort of visuals to attract attention. And in the early 1870s, there was an amnesty in British and Irish jails where quite a number of men who'd been arrested and tried and found guilty of treasonable offences. So they were found guilty of membership of the Fenian organisation, and they were, some of them were found guilty of plotting to bomb a number of places. And they would have served time in British and Irish prisons, one of them being O'Donovan Rossa, who was particularly badly treated. Another was John Dvoy, who became a great leader of Irish America. And when O'Donovan Rossa and John Dvoy, along with a number of other leaders, they arrived sort of in triumph, having been released from jail. And when they were released from jail, they were told they had to leave Ireland permanently. They were banished from Ireland forever, so they land into America. And O'Donovan Rossa and Dvoy come on a boat called the Cuba. And they become part of a gang known as the Cuba Five, and they were kind of senior figures. And they arrived to great fanfare, and they become extremely well known, particularly along the eastern seaboard. And that attracts a lot of attention and a lot of new members. And then the other big thing that attracted a lot of attention and new members was in the mid-1870s with the Catalpa Rescue. And the Catalpa was a whaling ship that was bought by the Fenian organisation. And it was kitted out and sent from Maine to Australia. And the purpose of it going from Maine to Australia was not on a whaling mission, but it was going to Fremantle in Western Australia, which was a penal colony at the time. And the idea was that it would rescue five Fenian prisoners from that Fenian colony and bring them back in triumph to America. Now, that sounds like a completely bonkers plan in the mid-1870s. You've no way of communicating. You don't know how long the ship's going to take. You don't know if the ship is ever going to even make it there. So it seems like a ridiculously expensive and futile plan. But the remarkable thing is that it takes a year for the ship to get to Fremantle, and they do manage to get these five Fenian prisoners, and they achieve their escape. And they sail back to New York, and they are greeted in triumph. And the mayor of New York comes down and welcomes them to New York. And in Dublin and in Cork, in Ireland, they have candlelight processions to say how wonderful this is. And that brings with it huge numbers of new members to the Fenian organization in Clonagel. And it brings with it money, because the more members you have, the more money you have coming into the coffers. So they have a number of those sort of very important propaganda victories, which helps bolster the numbers in the United States.
And this really does, like you mentioned, a huge surge in members' result, but also including two very, of course, main characters in this story, Alexander Sullivan and Patrick Cronin, joined right about that time. So let's talk about first Alexander Sullivan. Who is he before we get to who is Dr. Patrick Cronin?
Alexander Sullivan was an Irish-American, and he had a very sort of checkered career. He is a very interesting individual in the sense that he has a number of different and very important sort of facets to his life. He becomes involved in Irish republicanism in the mid-1870s after sort of the triumph of the Catalpa. But before that, he had a number of different careers. So he was a respectable businessman in some ways. He owned a shoe store in Detroit. That shoe store had a mysterious fire that burnt it to the ground, and he was suspected of arson. Now, he fled Detroit before the trial could happen, and he ended up heading towards the southern states, where he became a tax collector, he became a newspaper owner. He ended up back in Chicago, where he was a journalist for a short period. He then became a city official. He was a postmaster at one point, and then eventually he qualified as a lawyer. And all of that, during all of this period, he was involved in American politics, not Irish politics. So he was an abolitionist at one point. He was a member of the Republican Party. He was a Democrat at another point. He was a gambler at a later point. And he had all of these sort of a myriad of different careers before really he came to Irish republicanism in the mid-1870s. And then he very quickly established himself as a key figure in Irish republicanism, both in the United States and very specifically in Chicago.
You talk about avoiding scandal or overcoming it. You chronicle about an actual, much more serious case. Tell us about the most serious charge that he overcame in Chicago.
Well, soon when he moved to Chicago, he first worked as a journalist and then attended law school. And it was while he was qualifying as a lawyer that he became involved in, I suppose, the first thing that brought him to a lot of people's attention. His wife was a school teacher, Margaret Sullivan, who had also left her position as a school teacher and become a journalist. And she went on to become a very well-known journalist. But she remained involved in education matters in Chicago. And at one significant meeting about the Board of Education in Chicago, it was alleged that a rumor had circulated to say that she was using undue influence with the mayor in order to have certain Catholic schools established. And when Alexander Sullivan heard that her honor had been insulted, he discovered who had made these comments, and he went to this man's house. And the man who'd made these comments was a man called Francis Hanford, who was a school principal in the Chicago area. And he went to this man's house with his wife, and there was an altercation, and Sullivan shot the man dead. And there were two trials. He was tried twice for the murder of Francis Hanford. On the first occasion, the jury couldn't come to a conclusion, and on the second occasion, he was acquitted. Though it's very clear from the evidence that we can see now that the jury then was bribed to find in his favour. So it was in many ways an inauspicious start to his career in journalism and in law in Chicago. But he weathered that storm in the way that he weathered almost every other storm.
Now tell us about Dr. Cronin.
Dr. Cronin we know a lot less about than we do about Alexander Sullivan. And that's certainly one of the challenges of writing a book based on a secret society, in that they don't have huge records. But Patrick Henry Cronin was born in Ireland. He was born in a place called Buttevant in County Cork, in the sort of south of the country. And he, along with the rest of his family, like many, many others, emigrated from Ireland in 1847, which was known as Black 47. It was the worst year of the Irish famine. And they travelled around quite a bit. They didn't settle for a number of years, but eventually they settled in Canada. And when Cronin had finished his schooling, he returned to the United States. And then he started off in the mining regions of Pennsylvania, and he ended up in St. Louis, Missouri, where he worked in a number of not particularly impressive jobs, but he eventually got a sponsorship from a timber merchant who sponsored his way through medical school. And he qualified as a medical doctor in St. Louis, and he worked there as a medical doctor until 1882, when he moved to Chicago and took up a position as a doctor in Cook County Hospital, a position he held for quite a short period because he decided he wanted to be a doctor to primarily to an Irish community. So he set up in sort of private practice and had two private surgeries in Chicago itself, where a lot of his patients were Irish immigrants.
How did Alexander Sullivan get involved in, and how much did he get involved in this Clannagael?
He threw himself with great enthusiasm into Clannagael as soon as he joined it, and he very rapidly rose to the ranks. He was a very smart man, he was very articulate, he spoke very well, and people either loved him or hated him, and so he had a huge sort of coterie of very, very firm followers. So he joins in the mid-1870s, and by 1881, when there's a convention, Clannagael convention in Chicago, he essentially, by 1881, he essentially is in charge of Clannagael, not just in Chicago, but in the United States. And he's not just in charge of Clannagael, he's also involved in constitutional nationalism. So he's involved in the Land League in America, which was more of a constitutional, it wasn't dedicated to using force to promote an Irish Republic. So he had his finger kind of in every possible pie. And by 1881, he's the leader of what became known as the Triangle. And the Triangle was Clannagael, and they were called the Triangle because he signed any of these sort of internal memos that would go around rather than signing with his own name, because it would absolutely identify him. He signed it with this, just a symbol, which is the symbol was the triangle.
Right. When you talk about his involvement with the Klan, too, there was a lot of changes, significant changes, as you write, in the structure of the Klan organization. The executive committee was reduced from 18 members to 5, and the makeup of the Revolutionary Directory, which coordinated the Klan and the Irish Republican Brotherhood policy, was altered as well. Tell us about a little bit more about the violent or the faction that was planning and resorting or talking and discussing such things as using dynamite and violence in its approach.
Well, they did reduce sort of the makeup of the sort of leadership of Clannagael. And in addition to sort of reducing the number of people who were at the helm, one of the key things to these organizations was that they would, essentially what was meant to happen was that in America they would raise the money, and the sister organization in Ireland would be the one to decide on the policy, because they were on the ground and they knew what was happening. Now, Alexander Sullivan became increasingly frustrated with the Irish Republicans in Ireland. He felt that they were too slow to act. They felt that they were raising all the money and that nothing was happening in Ireland or in Britain. And so he determined that they would just ignore the leadership of Irish Republicanism, who was based in Ireland, and that they themselves would run what he called, and others called, a dynamite war. So he wasn't the first to think of this. In fact, there had been an earlier period where this had also been used. But this was on paper certainly, a very well-planned campaign. And the idea was that you would train young Irish Americans in the use of dynamite, which wasn't difficult to do because many of them were using dynamite in the building of railways and in mining, so they already knew how to do that, and that they would be sent from America to Britain. And the plan was that they would then blow up a series of targets. Most of these targets were in London, so they would blow up strategic targets or high-profile targets, so they would blow up things like the Tower of London, London Bridge, the Houses of Parliament, Scotland Yard, some tube stations, and that would generate an enormous amount of attention, and it would also generate an enormous amount of fear, so that the British Parliament would be forced to discuss the Irish question. Now, this wasn't a universally accepted plan, and there were a number of reasons why it wasn't. One was that some of those in favour of using force did not want to risk lives, and so they were in favour of using force only in places where there wouldn't be casualties, human casualties. And they felt it was very risky to attack things like tube stations and to presume that you wouldn't injure or kill civilians. And the second reason that some people were opposed to it is that there was some progress being made in terms of getting home rule for Ireland, which wasn't going to be a republic, but it would give Ireland back a parliament. And it was believed that any chance that Ireland had of getting home rule, which was certainly a step towards freedom, would be damaged by setting off these bombs. And so that began a very serious split within the clan, with one group on the side of Alexander Sullivan in favour of this dynamite campaign, and another group on the side of John Devoy, who was one of the leaders, and also Patrick Henry Cronin, the doctor in Chicago, who really disagreed with this dynamite war. Now, the dynamite war went ahead, and 15 bombing missions were sent. They were all unsuccessful. So the British authorities, the Secret Service, knew about them, and in many cases the men were arrested before they got to plant their bombs anywhere. So it wasn't a successful campaign, but even before it had failed, there were issues to do with, you know, agreement over the policy.
Why did Devoy and P.H. Cronin disagree with the use of dynamite?
It wasn't so much, I mean, they weren't opposed to the use of force in itself, but they didn't think the timing was right, and they didn't like the idea of the organisation in America overruling the organisation in Ireland, and they felt that those in Ireland ought to be making the decisions because they were much closer, you know, to what was actually going on, and they understood the nuances of politics better than someone in the United States would do. So they didn't like that overruling. They didn't think that the targets that were being chosen were well chosen. They thought there was going to be too high a chance of there being civilian casualties, and they thought the timing of it was all wrong. So for many reasons, they opposed Sullivan's plans.
The idea that, or the fact that the dynamite missions were interrupted or intercepted, again, plays into the idea of the spies and informers. Is that what Alexander Sullivan and his cohorts partially chalked this up to, that they needed to rein in the informers and the spies within their organization?
Not really, and that's the very odd thing, because most Irish secret societies had always had an issue and a problem with informers. And the strange thing about this is that they had so many failed missions, and nobody really began to talk about how there must be an informer in a way that you would imagine that it would have been much more thought about and much more talked about, and that there would have been assumption that there would, that there were spies and informers. Now, it's something that later becomes an issue. But at the time when all these missions were failing, I've certainly not come across any or many letters where somebody says we couldn't possibly just be unlucky every time. Somebody must be giving this information. At no point during that period does that seem to be the case. Now, they later talk about how there must have been a spy, but they don't do it at the actual time, which is strange because Irish secret societies have been bedeviled by spies in the past.
Now, let's talk about P.H. Cronin and which persons in the Clan na Gael in the split or otherwise that were supportive of his idea, or when did he get the idea that Sullivan and his cohorts were channeling money or funneling money to their own use? When did he make that realization, and how, and tell us about that.
Well, he came to that conclusion in the mid-1880s, in 1885, and he came to this conclusion as a result, really, of that failed dynamite campaign. Because the dynamite campaign had failed, because a number of men had been arrested and imprisoned, there was a campaign in the United States to raise money specifically to look after the families of the dead or the imprisoned dynamiters. So many of them had wives and many of them had children. And so this campaign began, and it raised a lot of money, because people wanted those families to be looked after. But the families never got the money. And in fact, there are a number of letters from the widow of one particular man called Mackie Lomasney, who had been killed while setting his bomb, saying that she had a number of children, they'd had no money, and that they really needed money. And this prompted Cronin to wonder what had happened to the money. And he found a paper trail which indicated that about $100,000 had been funneled into the private banking account of Alexander Sullivan, and that money had gone from Alexander Sullivan's account and had bought stock on the Board of Trade in Chicago, and that money had then completely disappeared. Now, the money had disappeared not because Sullivan had ultimately disappeared with anything to do with the stock. That money had been a bad investment, and the value of the stock that he bought had completely collapsed. But the fact was that he had taken that money, put it in his private bank account, and invested it. Now, he claimed that he'd invested it for Clonagale and that the organisation would benefit from whatever advance or whatever increase in value he'd made. Now, that seems unlikely to a large extent, but as soon as Cronin saw this, he thought, and it really confirmed what he'd previously thought, he believed that Alexander Sullivan was what he called a professional patriot. And by that it was a huge insult to call someone a professional patriot. A professional patriot simply meant that you were interested in Irish freedom, but only for what you could get out of it. So for his own advancement in America, and not actually for Irish freedom in itself. Cronin firmly believed that Alexander Sullivan was his professional patriot, that he really wasn't dedicated to Ireland, but he was dedicated to himself. And that set in train, a number of things that would ultimately lead to, Cronin's death.
How did he go about, once he had this realization and recognition, what did he do? Who did he rally support from, and what was the extent of his criticism in terms of the public arena?
Well, he began internally. So he began by telling other members of the secret society, so it remained an internal matter. And that became known to Alexander Sullivan, because obviously Chicago, you know, it's a big city, but the Irish community within Chicago and the radical Irish community is quite a small community. So he was then charged with treason for making these accusations against the leader of Clonagale, and a trial was held within Clonagale itself. And he was charged with treason for making these accusations, and he was found guilty of treason, and he was expelled from Clonagale. Now, as soon as he was expelled from Clonagale, he begins to bring his accusations to a much wider audience. So essentially, he'll talk to the Irish community more broadly, not just those who are a member of this society, and he begins to talk to journalists. So you see appearing in newspapers, in Chicago papers particularly, mutterings about all not being well within the Irish community in Chicago, and Patrick Henry Cronin making a number of allegations. So that's quite a slow, you know, but there's a growing awareness within Chicago that Alexander Sullivan, who's quite high profile individual, he's a high profile lawyer, and was well known, that accusations are being levelled against him. And Sullivan is very, very unhappy that his reputation has been tarnished in this way.
What is P.H. Cronin's criticism effect in Ireland, Britain, and with the public in America, the Irish citizenry in America?
At the time, it has no impact. His criticism has no impact in Ireland or in Britain. That criticism is not picked up. And in fact, it's like so many of these stories. If he hadn't been killed, then I think that story would have died a death. But the fact that he dies makes it an international story. So while he's alive saying these things, it's not going much outside Chicago. So if you went to New York and spoke to Irish Americans in New York, they would probably not have heard of Cronin. But as soon as he is dead, everybody has heard of him and everybody knows the story. So it is like so many other cases of murder. It's once the person has been killed, they suddenly become a household name, and whatever they've been interested in or whatever they've been involved in suddenly becomes headline news. But up until his death, his campaign was restricted largely to Chicago.
What are a couple important events prior to his, before we talk about his murder and the, just prior to that, the mystery of the missing P.H. Cronin? So let's talk about just the couple events prior that were a catalyst, I would say, that led to his murder.
Well, there's a couple of things, I think, that bring it all to a head. Because Clonagay was so split, this split had gone on for more than 3 years at this point, members of the clan sat down and said, we really need to essentially close this split. Let's air our dirty linen in a very enclosed environment. Let's investigate whether or not Sullivan took that 100,000. So we'll have a meeting which will take place in New York, and it'll bring everybody together, including Cronin and Sullivan, and we will thrash it all out, and we will then emerge from that united. Whatever that finds, we will still emerge from that united. And so that happens, except they don't emerge united. This trial of Sullivan and this investigation to Sullivan is very much, it's a false investigation, and Sullivan ends up being cleared of any accusations of wrongdoing. And Cronin is not happy with this. So instead of having agreed that everything would be fine, assuming they'd all sort of shake hands and that they'd all go their separate ways, that doesn't happen. He returns to Chicago from New York, and he's absolutely adamant that he's going to continue this campaign against Sullivan. Now, at the same time, there are things happening in London that do have an impact on what happens in Chicago. At the same time as the trial of Sullivan and Cronin and all those accusations are taking place in New York, there's a thing called the Parnell Commission taking place in London. The Parnell Commission was a sort of a trial of Charles Stewart Parnell, who was the leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party, so a constitutional political party. Now, there had been accusations levelled against Parnell that he had associates in America who were determined to use force. Now, if those links could be proven, that would really damage Parnell's standing as a parliamentarian. And so a lot of those people he was supposed to have known and associated with were people like Alexander Sullivan and John Devoy. So while there's one thing happening in New York and ultimately in Chicago, there's this second case taking place in London. And where the two meet is in February of 1889, when there's a surprise witness takes the stand in the Parnell Commission in London, and he turns up. He's travelled all the way from America. He turns up, and he's a very elegant-looking gentleman with a proper waxed moustache, and he takes the stand, and he announces that his name is Thomas Beach, but for 25 years he's been in America with an alias, and his alias is Henri Le Caron, and he's pretended to be a Frenchman for 25 years. And for that quarter of a century, this Frenchman, or this Englishman masquerading as a Frenchman, has been a spy. And he's been a spy in the pay of the British Secret Service. And he can prove, he says, these links between Alexander Sullivan and Charles Stewart Parnell, which would obviously seriously damage Parnell. Now, these are sort of devastating revelations. He had never been suspected as being a spy. He was an extremely close friend of Alexander Sullivan. And during his testimony, he was alleged to have suggested that there were other spies in Chicago. And people who didn't like Cronin thought, aha, this is it. He must be the other spy. Something that made no sense at all, because to be a spy, you need to be close to the leadership. And in fact, everything Cronin had done had pushed himself as far away as possible from the leadership. But people wanted to condemn, so certain people wanted to condemn Cronin, and this was how they were going to do it. And so rumours began to circulate in Chicago that not only was Le Caron a spy, but so too was Cronin. And once rumours began to circulate that he was a spy, essentially his days were numbered.
Tell our audience about what Camp 20 was in terms of its relation to Clandegill, and who was this important to Camp 20 important to?
Yeah, Camp 20 is very important. Each of the in the way in which the Clandegill was organized, you joined a camp, and your camp had a particular number. So Camp 20 was one of the camps in Chicago, and each camp had a fairly limited number of members, and you were supposed to really, though this doesn't work really in the Irish community because people knew everybody, you were supposed to only know the people within your camp so that secrets would remain secret. Now, Camp 20 was the camp that Alexander Sullivan was a member of. And there were a number of other men. There were sort of maybe 25 members of Camp 20 who were all very loyal to Alexander Sullivan because he wasn't the leader of their camp. A man called John F. Beggs was what was known as the senior guardian. But despite not being the official leader, he really was in charge of Camp 20. And that was the camp that was most loyal to Alexander Sullivan.
Now, you say he was basically labeled a spy as of February, as a confluence of events occurred. So tell us about the plan to murder P.H. Cronin.
Well, the plan was hatched very soon after Le Caron, or Beach, depending on whether he uses his real name or his alias, after he gave his evidence. And there's evidence that a number of men came together and decided that the best thing to do with Cronin was to have him killed. And so they plot, they have a number of plots, not all of which are put into force, but Cronin really feels his life is in danger and he begins to carry a gun around with him. And he also, he's called out on a number of kind of fake medical emergencies to vacant plots. So he is very conscious that there are people who have not his best interests at heart. But this group who conspire to take Cronin out of the picture, ultimately what they do is they rent a cottage in the north of Chicago, in what is now a suburb called Lakeview, but actually in 1889 was a separate jurisdiction, it was a separate city. It doesn't get brought into Chicago until later in 1889 as part of an annexation. So they hire this cottage, they rent a cottage from a Swedish couple called the Carlsons, and they rent it using aliases, and they say that it's for a particular family who are moving, I think, from Baltimore and are going to move in. And the family, of course, never move in. And they also establish a connection with Cronin, though he thinks it's an innocent connection. He's approached by a man called Patrick O'Sullivan, who's no relation to Alexander Sullivan. But Patrick O'Sullivan owns an ice house. And ice houses do very well in the summer when Chicago is very hot. And they go around and they sell ice to both individuals and to businesses. And they travel around and they cut chunks of ice off the back of a lorry and they sell it so that people can keep their food from going off. And he approaches Cronin and says, during the summer months when I'm busiest, would you be my doctor on call? And I will pay you a retainer, a monthly retainer for this business. But if I have an employee who gets injured cutting ice, would you attend him? And Cronin says yes. And his only sort of method of making sure that he's not called out in a false call is he says, I will only attend if whoever comes to call for me brings a copy of your business card so I know it's a legitimate call out. So that's agreed, and the two men go on their way. But it is part of the conspiracy. And so on the evening of the 4th of May, 1889, there's a knock on Cronin's door at his surgery, and a very panicked young man is there saying, there's been an accident. He presents a card to Cronin from Patrick O'Sullivan's ice house, and so Cronin packs up his medical case, hops in the buggy, the horse that's waiting outside, and disappears, and he's never seen alive again.
Now, how does the rumor or the story get that Cronin disappears and likely took off to Canada? Where does that rumor emanate from?
Well, one of a number of rumors. What happens is Cronin disappears that Saturday night and he doesn't return. And so the next morning, his landlords and friends are concerned because it's out of character. And so they go to three people or three organizations. They go to the police, they go to the Pinkerton Detective Agency, and they go to the newspapers. And they employ Pinkertons themselves to look for him. They tell the police that they're sure that he's been murdered, and they give them the backstory as to why they think he would be murdered, and they tell the newspapers. And they have a lot of connections, a lot of of Cronin's friends were newspaper men, so they were able to get this story in the press. But Alexander Sullivan is married to a very well-known journalist, so he too, and his sort of those putting forward his side, also have access to the press. So Cronin, there's no body or anything found. So over 2 weeks, the press run with all sorts of stories. Firstly, they say that he'd run away because he was having an affair with one of his patients, and that the husband had found out, so he had to skip town. Another is that he was performing illegal abortions and one had gone wrong, so he had to skip town. Another man comes forward and says that he murdered Cronin. He says that he had a dream where Queen Victoria told him to murder Cronin, and that he hired four Italian brigands and gave them cutlasses, and they killed Cronin. Now, that man ends up in a mental asylum by the end of the year. And then there's a rumour that he's left town because he's going to turn up in London and become, you know, give evidence just as Henri Le Caron had done. And a final rumour is that he's gone to Canada, that he's just had enough of all the pressure and he's gone to Canada. And that, in a way, isn't a surprise because that's where most of his family are settled. And in fact, a reporter on a Canadian paper says he meets Cronin and he conducts a whole interview with Cronin, which is published in the Chicago papers, where there's a full interview saying, yes, when I got fed up, I couldn't, you know, function as a doctor. It was easier to leave and settle in Toronto. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm fed up of all this Irish nonsense. And that's published as an interview. So there are all sorts of rumours, but that's the most, I suppose, seems the most authentic and the one that makes most sense. But it's not, of course, true.
Now, you say that all speculation is finally quashed on the afternoon of May 22nd. Three employees of the Board of Public Works were sent to investigate a putrid smell emitting from the storm sewer at the corner of Foster and Broadway. And they looked through the iron gates and they noticed something blocking the sewer entrance. So tell us what they found.
Well, they initially thought they'd found a dog, the body of a dog had fallen into the sewer. And when they went to pull the body out, they realised actually it wasn't an animal, it wasn't a dog at all, it was a human. And when they pulled the body out of the sewer, they who hadn't known Cronin, but they immediately all went, this must be the body of Cronin. And he was naked. And the only thing he had sort of left on him was a holy medal. That is a medal that Catholics often wear as a protection against harm, which had clearly not done him any good at all. And it was very clear from even though he'd obviously was quite badly decayed from having been in the sewer for 2 weeks, it was very clear that he'd been beaten very brutally around the head before being dumped in the sewer. And so that put paid to all of the rumours that he'd disappeared to Canada or run away. It was very clear that he'd met with a particularly brutal end.
Now, he was disfigured just from the decomposition and that bloating, and so he had also been hit about the head, like you say. What they found was weapons like, which would connect him somewhat to this ice house. What were the weapons that they discovered were used in the attack?
Well, they never actually found the weapon that was used. What they assumed is it had been an ice pick, and that he'd been hit around the head with an ice pick. I think he was probably actually attacked with a chisel, but they very quickly began to visit the ice house of Patrick O'Sullivan, and that led them quite quickly to a vacant house just beside the ice house, which was owned by this Swedish family called the Carlsons. And when they knocked on their door, the Carlsons admitted that they knew that something bad had happened in the house, because when their tenant disappeared, they went into the house and they noticed it was covered in bloodstains and that something unpleasant had happened. But they didn't report it because they felt that if they reported it, they'd never be able to rent the house out again. You know, if it became known that some murder had taken place there or something really dreadful had happened. And so very quickly the police were able to find the scene of the crime, if not actually the weapon used. And there was a rocking chair and a number of other things that were completely had been destroyed by the brutality of the attack on Cronin.
They also discovered a blood-stained trunk on Montrose and Broadway. So tell us a little bit about that discovery.
Yes. They'd found that trunk actually 2 weeks before. They'd found the trunk just after Cronin had disappeared. And it was a bloodstained trunk that had clearly been thrown into a ditch. And it had quite a lot of cotton within it that was also bloodstained and some human hair. And the police, who really weren't terribly interested, and there were two police forces kind of trying to investigate, and neither of them were particularly committed. So they had dismissed that. Because there was no body, they dismissed it as not relevant. But as soon as Cronin's body was found, they put two and two together, and they decided that what had happened was he was killed in the house. His body was then placed in the trunk, and that the trunk was, and the intention was, I think, that the trunk would be taken to Lake Michigan, to the shore of Lake Michigan, and put on board a boat, and the body and trunk tipped over the side into Lake Michigan. But for whatever reason happened, the boat didn't meet them. And so instead they had to improvise, so they put the body in a sewer, and then they just dumped the trunk on the side of the road. But it wasn't until the body was found that they made, sort of they connected the dots in terms of the trunk.
What I found really fascinating with this story is that immediately after discovery and the announcement that P.H. Cronin's body had been found, there was a hordes of people that went to the police station, went in and out of the morgue, were looking, peering through the morgue window to get a sight of anybody in the morgue or the body. And then the crime scene itself, people trampled all around that area as well. So anybody thinking that this is a new phenomenon or a recent phenomenon, not so recent phenomenon of people being fascinated by this and heading to the scene of the crime.
You're absolutely right. That was one of the things that really drew me to sort of writing about the case, was the sort of public fascination with this murder was incredible. And it's partly to do with the newspapers. It's sort of that period where newspapers are reporting on, you know, the more sensational the crime, the better, as far as they're concerned. And so, you know, hundreds of columns of newsprint were spent describing the murder and how he was beaten and the police investigation. And you're right, hundreds of people turned up. They wanted to see the body. When he was laid out in at the end of Michigan Avenue, and you couldn't actually see the body when he was sort of put on display, but there was a closed casket, and thousands of people filed past just to see the closed casket. And these people didn't know him. They just knew the story. And on the day he was buried, you've got 40,000 people lining the streets of Chicago. And the population of Chicago is about 1 million at the time. 40,000 people line Michigan Avenue. It's the largest funeral since Lincoln's funeral through the city. So I mean, it's an absolute phenomenal. They fill a Holy Name Cathedral with thousands, and more turn up to Union Depot, where the train that takes his body just north of Chicago to Evanston for burial, thousands more turn up to watch the burial. I mean, it's a complete phenomenon for a man that most of these people did not know, had never heard of before. And that's partly to do with things like the dime museums in Chicago. They were really quick to have waxworks. They had waxworks of the dead body. And as soon as the suspects are arrested, they've got waxworks of the suspects. So you don't even need to be literate in English in Chicago. And a huge number of people weren't. You know, it's a huge immigrant population. But you can still go and see what the body looked like after it came out of the sewer, which is a deeply unpleasant sight. But not only that, in the Carlton Cottage, newspaper men, journalists interfere with the crime scene, because they bring more blood. They bring ox blood and beef blood, and they distribute around to make it more gory than it already was. And then the family of the Carlsons, who own the cottage, far from not being able to rent it, they can't keep people away. So they open the cottage, and you can pay a dime to go to the cottage. You can have a little tour around. And then you can pay an extra dime if you want to take some blood-stained wood away with you as your souvenir. So it catches the public imagination in many, many ways, and dime novels are written about. There's at least two dime novels written about this murder. It's front page news right across the United States, in Canada, in Britain. It's in Welsh language newspapers. It's in New Zealand. It's in Australia. You know, had he not been murdered, the story of Alexander Sullivan taking that money would not be known. But as soon as he's dead, it takes on a whole, you know, life of its own.
Before we talk about a little bit more impact of his murder and his funeral and the resultant story that's now much bigger, as you say, than if he were to not be murdered, so now it's a much different story and much different response from the public. But what I found, again, equally incredible is this Whitechapel Club that you refer to, established by two journalists from the Chicago Herald in 1889, inspired by the Cronin murder and Jack the Ripper murders in London. And the theme of the club is sensational crime, rooms decorated with macabre memorabilia from hangings, murders, coffins served as tables and skulls as lampshades, handcuffs used by Martin Burke, shards of wood, like you say, from the Carlson cottage, and bloodstained cotton from a trunk that had Cronin's body. And apparently, 1889, it was ethically sound for journalists to collect memorabilia, and as you say, or evidence from cases they covered, and to tamper with the scene of the crimes sometimes and dismiss it as a joke. I found this incredibly fascinating.
Yeah, well, the Whitechapel Club is remarkable, and something I want to go back to and look at kind of again, because the journalists in many ways almost become the story themselves. And the journalists involved in the Whitechapel Club really do collect all of this memorabilia, and you know, that it's essentially their drinking den. So the table that they use is in the shape of a coffin. They use skulls as their lights. It's completely bonkers, and that building was demolished, so there's no kind of relics of it. But they were involved in all sorts of very bizarre things, and I think, in some ways, it's very representative of the late 19th century, and you can see it sort of in how things are reported. And Jack the Ripper, which is obviously, they were murders that took place in London around the same time as the Cronin murder. It's referenced all of the time in the press about how the Cronin murder has echoes of Jack the Ripper, though it really doesn't. But people are quick to make kind of those connections, and I think that in Chicago, the newspapers certainly took a certain, I suppose pleasure is the wrong word, but they were keen to show that they kind of had a murder that was just as fascinating as those that were taking place in London.
You also talk about, we'll analyze it a little bit later as you do, about whether the prosecution was aided by the journalists. But that was the tone. They were obviously in favor of prosecution. So tell us, equally fascinating, is how hard they had in finding a jury in this 2 months jury selection. So you talk about the longest or the biggest jury or longest jury selection process in U.S. judicial history. So tell us a little bit about that process and how difficult it was.
Well, yes, at the time it was the longest. In fact, I'm not sure what now is the longest sort of attempt to find 12 men. I suppose the closest, I suppose, comparison is something like the O.J. Simpson trial in terms of just the amount of attention it had. And one of the reasons it has that level of attention is that they eventually try five men are accused of murder. And one of those, and the reason that the press were so interested, one of the men that was charged was a man called Daniel Coughlin. And Coughlin had been the chief detective charged with finding Cronin when he went missing. And so if you're a newspaper man, that's just gold dust. Is that the man, sure, who was meant to find the missing man turns out to be the man accused of murder. And so for papers, this is just amazing. So there's hardly anybody in Chicago who hasn't read all the papers. And so when these people are called as potential jurors, then they're asked, one of the first questions is, do you have an opinion on the case? And they go, absolutely, they should hang. And then they get dismissed because clearly they're biased. So it takes the best part of 2 months before they can find 12 men who don't say that they don't have an opinion. And that's, you know, then once the trial gets up and running, it doesn't take particularly long to get through the evidence. In fact, it takes longer to pick 12 men than it does to actually have the trial.
What you write about the specter of bribery in terms of the jurors, so tell us what happens or the specter of it.
Yes, well, Chicago had a long tradition of jury bribing, and there were a number of alleged attempts to bribe jurors. So essentially where a juror would be bribed to find in favour of the defendants. And in one case, a note was put in the pocket of a juror with a necktie. And in it, he was told in the note, if he was going to kind of vote on behalf of the defendants, he was to wear that particular necktie the next day, and sort of money would come his way. Now, in that case, the juror went to the state's attorney and said, this is what's happening. There are attempts to bribe. And that's something that was very often the case in Chicago in the 19th century and well beyond, I think.
Now, you have the defense tried to split up O'Sullivan from Beggs and Burke and Coughlin, and this was a conspiracy to murder trial. There's no eyewitness, so they have to deal with some circumstantial evidence. But what I thought, again, was interesting and unusual is that the magnitude of the prosecution, they brought in private attorneys to be able to do this as well, rather than just relying. So tell us about that, which seemed unprecedented.
I mean, the big guns were certainly lined up for the trial. I mean, interestingly, Alexander Sullivan is never actually charged with the murder.
Right.
But everyone who's charged is a member of Camp 20. And it becomes clear that Sullivan didn't actually order the murder, but the murder took place because they thought he wanted Cronin dead. So he doesn't actually order the murder himself. And in fact, the murder does not help him at all. But the court of public opinion convicts Sullivan. But in order to, I suppose, convict the others, the state's attorney and those who were supporters of Cronin, they wage an enormous financial campaign. So not only is the state's attorney, who would normally just be the prosecutor, there's about 9 very senior attorneys who are part of the prosecution. And the defence are also very well represented. Each one of those men who is charged, and there are 5 men charged, have their own individual attorneys. And these are not wealthy men. So somebody's paying for those. Those men were not men who could have afforded to have an attorney themselves. Apart from one of them, Beggs could probably, if he was an attorney himself, but the rest of them would not have been able to afford significant legal representation. So it is, that's why I think the mention of kind of the O.J. Simpson case, these are the biggest guns that Chicago can put together in terms of legal teams.
Sure. Now you say October 23rd, the trial begins, and again, fascinating, 5,000 people want to attend this and get into a room that holds a couple hundred. And
yes.
And then what's interesting too is the newspapers are publishing transcripts of the trial. So they're also labeling, they're calling a terming Iceman O'Sullivan.
Yeah, I mean the papers, thousands of people turn up the first day, hundreds of people turn up every single day. It's always packed out. It's one of the first times that the newspapers come together and they pay for stenographers. So several newspapers, agree that they will pay for trial transcripts as a team in some ways, even though they're actually, obviously in competition with each other for sales. And there's an awful lot of colour pieces. So O'Sullivan becomes known as the Iceman because he owns the ice house. And they're completely fascinated with Dan Coughlin because he was the detective. So you get a huge amount of attention paid, page after page of the newspapers cover this on a daily basis, because it's absolutely the story of its time.
Now, there's a lot of claims by and a lot of action by the media itself, and especially the Tribune. So tell us about their claim or anyone's claim that they were the people that cracked this case, that the reporters were involved, because please explain the situation with the police at that time and their loyalties, it would seem, to this in this investigation and the interference in this. So tell us about that dynamic.
Well, the police in Chicago was disproportionately Irish. About half of the police force were made up of Irishmen, and the Irish made up about 17% of the population. So far more Irish were in the police force than sort of you would be expecting. You'd expect maybe 20% of the police force to be Irish, but in fact you get half of the police force. Now, not all of those were involved in Clonegale, but quite a lot were. And so certainly the press suggested that there were a lot of the police force who had a vested interest in this case not coming forward. And the newspapers prided themselves on having kind of discovered a lot of the clues and having brought that to the police. Now, some of that's hyperbole. They didn't discover all of it, but they certainly laid claim to having discovered a lot of it. But they were right. There were definitely elements within the police force that didn't want this trial or this case to go ahead. And there certainly were things that were discovered by the journalists that hadn't been discovered by the police. So I get, in some ways, I suppose it was a combined effort. But the newspapers certainly blew their own trumpet as much as they could.
Tell us about Pat Deenan and the evidence that he provided that linked O'Sullivan and Burke to the murder.
Yeah, well, he owned a livery stable, so he rented out horses and buggies, and he as the case sort of as the developments progressed, he recognised the description of the horse and buggy as being a horse and buggy he owned, and he recalled that Daniel Coughlin had booked that horse and buggy for the night that Crona disappeared, and so he went to the police and reported Coughlin's involvement, and the police initially dismissed him and said they weren't interested, and clearly this had nothing to do with Coughlin. And eventually Dinan took that higher and went to more senior police officials who took him seriously, and that was really the link that brought the detective into the murder investigation.
Now, you also talk about the importance of Edward Spellman and his visit to Chicago and Camp 20, so explain that to us.
Well, he was a senior figure in Clonegale, and he had been asked at one point for his sort of to take action against Cronin, and it had been sort of suggested in letters that if he didn't take action, people couldn't be responsible for what they did. And he said, "Well, look, there's nothing, just let it go." So he didn't have anything to do with Cronin's disappearance, but as soon as Cronin was discovered to have been murdered, Spellman did sort of step in and go to Camp 20 and say, you need to destroy any evidence that there might be that might link you to this murder. So most of the records, in fact all of the records of Camp 20, were burned or destroyed in some way when Spellman visited Chicago.
Now, it's interesting, there's no eyewitnesses, obviously, but there's 190 witnesses, everything from testifying about the meetings at Camp 20. There was a Conklin and Frank Scanlon testified that Cronin felt his life in danger. Tell us about the most important, in your mind, the most important event at the trial, the most pivotal point in that trial.
Well, I think the evidence given by Dinan is really key, because he links sort of all of the men together. I think his evidence is probably the most important. The rest, I think, builds up a very clear picture of the involvement of many of the others. But his is the crucial one, I think, that brings all of the men who were accused into the same circle and places them there. But I think the evidence of people like the Carlsons, who owned the cottage, and they were able to identify the man, Burke, who rented the cottage from them, they could identify him. They were able to prove that O'Sullivan and Burke knew each other. So I think the mixture of the Carlsons and Dinan are particularly important.
So tell us what happens ultimately in terms of the, I mean, it's interesting, the last summation by Longnecker, but tell us about how it, the trial concludes and sort of the result in terms of public sentiment.
Well, the public fully expected that the men would be found guilty and that they would be executed, though there's very little, there was very little to sort of back up their assumption that this would happen because there were very few executions in Chicago at the time. But public sentiment was definitely that that these men would be executed and found guilty. And so what ultimately happens is that one of them is acquitted, John Beggs, who was the senior guardian and leader of Camp 20. He was acquitted of being involved in the conspiracy, but three of them were found guilty of murder, but they were not sentenced to death. They were sentenced to life in prison. And the reason they weren't sentenced to death is because if to sentence someone to death, you have to have all 12 members of the jury to agree a death sentence. And in this case, only 11 members of the jury would agree a death sentence, and the 12th man was opposed to the death sentence in principle. Didn't matter. He was not in favour of the death sentence. So the public were disappointed. I think they were baying for blood and were disappointed that they didn't get their executions. But there were three men found guilty and three men sentenced to life in prison.
Again, what's most fascinating is the treatment of that one juror and how derided he was by the... Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, he is essentially hounded out of Chicago as a result because, you know, it's known who he is. He's a man called Mr. Culver, and he is essentially hounded out of Chicago. He has to put his house on sale within a month because of threats to his life and to the lives of his family members.
Now, what's the effect of this trial on the Clan na Gael?
Oh, it decimates Clan na Gael because it's basically its dirty linen was washed in public, and membership of the clan is destroyed. The position of Alexander Sullivan is destroyed. The clan never recovers really from this public kind of revelations about it. So it has huge repercussions for Clan na Gael, but it also has huge repercussions for the police force in Chicago. A number of men were sacked who were police officers because they were deemed to be sympathetic to Clan na Gael. They entirely reorganized how the policing system worked in Chicago. So and there were questions raised about jury bribing and the judiciary. So there were all sorts of kind of repercussions for that go beyond just the Irish community in Chicago that really spread much further afield.
In terms of that lucrative fundraising and that money and that political organization, Irish Republican Brotherhood and nationalism itself, what was its effect, this trial?
Well, the real impact is that money is not raised. And Irish Republicanism had relied very heavily on the dollar and on money raised in America to fund activity in Ireland and in Britain. And that stops. And that I think is very important, and it doesn't really start again until well into the 20th century. So it has massive repercussions in that sense, that sort of money that people were expecting to be sent back for these organisations are not sent back, and for more than a generation that continues.
Again, I found this fascinating too, is that you say the Camp 20 that was involved in all of this is actually, if I'm not miscorrect, expanded, and John Beggs, the person that was acquitted, is elected senior guardian?
Yes, that's true. They reassemble themselves almost immediately, and he becomes the leader again. Though they end up not really having any impact. They're not able to do very much. But they do reassemble almost immediately.
The effect of this trial also on, we just touched on it, but the sentiment of the public, the Irish community in America, what was its effect, essentially?
Well, I think it brought to light an issue that a lot of Americans felt about the Irish community, in that this idea of a dual loyalty or a hyphenated identity was brought to the fore and was not very favourably received. So there was apprehension in America about this idea that the Irish were more loyal to Ireland than they were to being American, and Americans felt that their loyalty should be first and foremost to America and to the United States, and that they really should leave the issue of sort of the old home country behind. And so this idea of hyphenated loyalty was something that was sort of disapproved of, and people began to think, well, you couldn't really trust the Irish, because not only are they kind of keeping one eye on what's happening in Ireland, but now there are murders taking place in its name on United States soil. And so that did not go down very well, particularly with those who were anti-immigrant, and there were a lot of those who were anti-immigrant in the United States at the end of the 19th century.
You speak in your book about the Clan na Gael and talk of if it was ever reunited, that Coughlin would be declared outlawed by the Irish race.
Yes, I mean, there was an attempt to reunite, which worked in 1900, but the Clan na Gael that was reunited in 1900 would never really had the power that they'd had before. But it was interesting that one of the things that united the two groups who had previously been divided was the fact that they would both sides condemned Coughlin. And Coughlin himself had ended up, he didn't serve a full term in prison and was ultimately released, but he ends up having to go on the run, and he dies under an assumed name on a banana plantation in Honduras, so very far from any freedom fighting for Ireland.
Right. What about Alexander Sullivan? What is his fate?
Well, he remains in Chicago. He remains a lawyer, but financially he is not in any position. He doesn't really have very much business. His position as the sort of the preeminent Irishman in Chicago is absolutely gone. He disappears. He's not seen in public for 5 years until 1895, so nearly 6 years after the murder. And so his role is absolutely diminished. He really does not have any authority at all. So even though he doesn't serve any time, his position is very much diminished as a result of the murder.
I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Blood Runs Green. If people are more interested, obviously I hope people are motivated to go and seek out this fantastic book. But if people are more interested in contacting you, or do you have a website or a Facebook page that people might be able to find out more information or look at your other work as well?
I do. I have a WordPress blog, which is called, it's Gillian M. O'Brien WordPress blog. I think it's called Murder, Mayhem, and Shiny Things. So quite a lot of what I'm working on is up on that. And my other contact details are on that blog. So, yeah, it would be great. It would be great to be in touch with some people.
I want to thank you very much for this interview and a fantastic read, Blood Runs Green, a fascinating story and a trip back in history and a fascinating, fascinating time. So I want to thank you very much for coming on and
thank you for having
discussing
me.
This book.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Good night.